I'm Father Mitch Pacwa, and welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. Tonight, as technology and computer algorithms seem to be poised to give us everything we think we need instantaneously, still, there are some answers in some connections that can only be found in a good book. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But before we get to that discussion, we want to talk briefly with the president of EWTN Studios, Mr. Peter Gagnon, about a brand new program that is going to debut on EWTN Plus. Peter, what is EWTN Plus?
Well, EWTN Plus is our new streaming app. It's on Roku and it's on many of the other platforms. Okay. And it's just a great user experience. It's very similar to other streaming platforms that are out there and on demand. And it's really, our team here did a great job putting that together. But we want to bring some new content there. And so this Monday, we're gonna be debuting a brand new series called Seeking Beauty with David Henry. David Henry is a Disney actor, a young director, and he goes throughout Italy in search of beauty in all aspects of liturgy, music, architecture, food, culture. And it's a travel series, which is beautifully shot. David does a great job, and you travel with him. So you're partnering with him as he seeks beauty in these different areas. And it's a great new offering. It's gonna debut. It's gonna be only on our EWTN Plus platform. So if, however you get EWTN, whether it's on Roku, whether it's on Google TV, or any other way you receive it, or even on your computer, even if EWTN Plus isn't launched, it'll still be on our on-demand site. So you can find it anywhere you find EWTN, and people should look for that on this coming Monday. It'll be debuting there, and it's gonna be 6 episodes, and we'll release the first 2 episodes and then an episode a week afterwards. And I think we have a trailer.
Yeah, I was gonna say, let's take a look at this clip of Seeking Beauty.
What if beauty was something more than we see? What if it was something we seek?
See how you can find God here.
I'm David Henry, and I've always believed there's more to beauty than what meets the eye.
This is just, it is breathtaking.
So I set out to search for something more. We're traveling across Italy through Rome, Florence, Venice, Milan, and more.
I like Milanese people. I think I'm gonna get used to it here.
Exploring the people, the culture, and the sacred art. To uncover the beauty that's been speaking to hearts for centuries.
Michelangelo has found the Lord at the end of his life.
It makes me emotional.
Along the way, I've met monks, musicians, artists.
I get fired up about this stuff, man.
What role do you think the artist has to play today?
Even a few fellow pilgrims.
Viva España! Viva!
And each one has helped me uncover deeper meaning.
Trying to understand the mind of Caravaggio.
This is such a full circle moment for me.
Because beauty isn't just decoration. It's the language of the soul. Come, join me to see how timeless beauty still speaks to us today and how it just might change the way we see everything.
Well, that looks really cool.
Yeah, this was one of our first initiatives for EWTN Studios. So I think people are really going to like that series.
Yeah, looks wonderful. Well, good. Thank you very much. We'll show the Seeking Beauty with David Henry on EWTN Plus beginning January 19th. So try to get a hold of that. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with tonight's guest. So please stay with us. Welcome back. Our guest tonight acknowledges that while the seemingly ever-present smartphones might give us many answers at our fingertips, the immediacy of all that information is leading to a growing superficiality in our personal connections with other people. He says real interactions, such as engagement with great stories in the form of ink on paper books, or observing a fine piece of art from just a few feet away, taking in all the details, or listening to a live performance of your favorite piece of music, are real experiences that can help us cultivate a deeper understanding of ourselves and others, and thus overcome the limitations of technology. Here to tell us more about it is the Executive Director of the Center for Beauty and Culture at Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas. And he's also the author of a book, Why Literature Still Matters. Please welcome our guest, Dr. Jason M. Baxter. Good to have you back, Jason.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. It's been a while. You were here some years ago, and it's good to have you back. And I think part of the relevancy of this comes as we've seen this past year, a number of school systems have banned cell phones and discovered that that has improved learning and behavior. Mm-hmm. Some of them were somewhat surprised, but right. It really did have a big impact on people learning better and on the way that they acted, and also had an impact of decreasing depression among the students. Those are significant changes. Tell us about some of what you're asking folks to do here, because it may be as useful outside of school as it is inside school.
Yeah. So I run a program called for Angelico Fellows at Benedictine College. It's an honors program, but it's not just, you know, for smart kids with good test scores. But it's for kids, as I like to put it, who have a heart for beauty and think that beauty is a path to holiness. Mm-hmm. And so our goal is not just to have, say, you know, theoretical reflection in which we talk about what is beauty and, you know, theologically, philosophically, but also to talk about, but also to create opportunities for experience. So we do go to concerts together, and then we talk about it afterwards. We have screenings of good films, mm-hmm. and then talk about it afterwards. And probably the most exciting thing that we've done is we went to Scotland and did a 62.5-mile hike from Melrose, Scotland, across the borders down into England and crossed the Pilgrim Sands to Lindisfarne Island when the tide was out, and we made a film about that.
You can walk to Lindisfarne?
You can walk, yeah. If you time it just right, they're completely paranoid that someone's going to get stuck on the causeway, and so they have all kinds of warning signs at every single corner of the village. But yes, you can walk to Lindisfarne when the tide goes out. And I think this is kind of, you know, germane to what you were saying, right? To do it in the ancient medieval way, you have to take off your boots, you have to take off your socks, and you have to walk across the cold sands. And that was not just sort of refreshing for the feet after 62 miles of hiking, but rather, you feel close to the earth, feel close to the land. It's a way of experiencing, you know, mm-hmm. the sacred in a simple way, which is not merely for the brain. So I think you're right. If we're seeing finally that we're waking up, that our screens are not improving our educational endeavors, I think it's in part because we realize how important all these other senses are for the very act of memory, and perhaps more importantly, not just for memory, but the ability to actually take it into me, right? Not just to know something in the brain, but to, as I like to put it with my students, right? Not just to stream, but to download from the head to the heart.
Yeah. And there's something, some weeks ago, I had a guest who was describing his visit to the Louvre, which is in Paris. And it's used to be a palace, now it's an art museum, open to the public. And he was, you know, really dismayed that all these people were gathered around the most popular place in the Louvre.
That's right.
Is
the Mona Lisa.
Exactly.
Behind bulletproof glass and with 300 people in front of you holding up their phones to photograph it.
Yes. Right. Yes, that's exactly the scene he described. And, you know, that, you know, all these people are seeing this great work of art. But they want more to take a photograph rather than what you described. Going and seeing the details, paying attention to the way the strokes work and the colors and all the, you know, what is so intriguing about the smile. And they were there to get a photograph of themselves looking at the Mona Lisa rather than looking at the Mona Lisa, yet alone the rest of this tremendous art that is throughout that whole museum. And this is not the way to appreciate art. It's right. not yeah. scoring a, I got to see this. It's about experiencing what the artist is saying.
Right, yeah. Well, I know that my students are watching tonight, and they're going to roll their eyes when they hear me quoting my favorite Korean-German philosopher, Byung-Chul Han. But Byung-Chul Han says in his book, Saving Beauty, that our taking of selfies has now become pathological. And by that, what he means is, I agree with him, that when we see something moving, a landscape, right, a river, you know, in Paris, a beautiful painting in Rome, we have something that awakens inside, and we want to interact with it. Mm-hmm. And we want, in some sense, to for it to become part of me and for, you know, for me to become part of it. But in our culture, the sort of quick, you know, digital fix, right, the easy itch to scratch is just to pull out my phone and take a quick picture of me in front of it, right? Or to wait in line for a half hour in front of the Mona Lisa and do it eventually, right? But Byung-Chul Han says, in some sense, it's a noble impulse, right, to photograph, to try to draw close to it. But because it's an insufficient means, because it's too superficial, because it's too shallow, I will feel the need to do it again very soon, and then again very soon. In some sense, it's like eating food which lacks nutritional value, right? That it lacks, you know, sort of proper, healthy vitamins and minerals, right? I'll keep eating and eating and eating as I'm sort of chasing that nutrition, but can never find it. And this way, the pathological taking of selfies is an expression that this is beautiful, that I admire it, that I want to associate myself with this beautiful object. But precisely because it's too easy, it's too quick, it's too external, and it's too superficial, it's going to leave us hungrier afterwards than we were before.
I led a lot of pilgrimages to different places. And one of the things I was always concerned about with my own groups is not that we walk through the streets of Jerusalem and take selfies at each of the stations of the cross or something, but rather that we pray the stations as we go. That is what makes a pilgrimage, as opposed to being a tourist. And mm-hmm. the famous right. touristic face-off is when two tourists take pictures of each other taking pictures of the other one. You know, this is, you're missing the place, and you're focusing on capturing these photographs. And by missing the place, say on a pilgrimage, if you're not praying the pilgrimage, mm-hmm. it's not even a pilgrimage, it is just a touristic visit.
Right.
And that was something that I never wanted my groups to do. You know, of course they're going to take photographs. Like your philosopher says, there's nothing evil about that.
Right.
But it can be superficial if you don't experience the place.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a chapter in the book which is, you know, it's kind of critical of our practices, I mean, precisely because we feel so malnourished afterwards. But most of the book is actually positive and upbeat, because fortunately there are alternatives to the pathological taking of selfies, right? And and we call those the arts, right? And in the book, I just sort of describe the arts, especially literature, as what you could call a technology of inwardness, right? It's the ability not just to see beauty, but then to try to close the gap between what I see and who I am. Mm-hmm. And this can come up in turn. I mean, this we find paintings like this, we find music like this, we find poems like this, we find sketches like that. And so most of the book is actually, is upbeat. And the students, I think my students have found it actually empowering, right? Once you've been sort of liberated from this sort of pull to superficiality, then the encouragement is there's all kinds of traditional arts. And this, I think, is actually where we have as much to learn from our ancestors as anyone else. Mm-hmm. As good as we are, say, at technology and power, which are good things, of course, right? The ability to broadcast our conversation is a good thing, right? I mean, the ability to have scientific discoveries, of course these are good things. But my contention in why literature still matters is that literature and the arts in general are not just nice or cute or entertaining, but actually urgent for their recovery. And the more technological that we become, the greater the need will come, almost sort of direct correspondence mm-hmm. with recovering these old arts. Because as we sort of extend our power externally, right, as we externalize what's interior to us, we're going to need to have something to rebuild, to restore, to rehabilitate, almost therapeutically, the depth and inwardness that our ancestors were particularly good at.
The perspective you bring, namely that there's a need for a cure, there's a need for a healing of the effects of this technology. Describe that more. What do you mean by what do you see as the problem that is creeping into the ready availability of so much technology?
Yeah, well, I mean, the same Byung-Chul Han has written another book called The Crisis of Narration, and if you think about that, you might at first think crisis of narration. I mean, we have 700 new shows go up every year on Netflix. There are something like 50 to 70,000 new novels that come out every year in English alone, even excluding the YA category, right?
How many novels?
50 to 70,000, right?
Wow.
We're just flooding the market with stories and with narratives. And so you think at first, really, a crisis of narration? But what Byung-Chul Han has in mind is that the way that we sort of habituate ourselves to communicating is quick little updates. Here's what I'm doing now. Here's what I'm doing now. Here's what I'm doing now. And he says that we almost sort of treat our lives like little dots, little points on a number line, right? He calls it an additive way of thinking about our lives. Experience one, experience two, experience three, but they're just in little kilobytes. Those individual sort of, that data cloud of experiences doesn't make up a narration. It doesn't make up a story. It doesn't connect me to a past. It doesn't give me a mission. It's just individual sort of moments swirling around. And so that's where he suggests, and this is what I've devoted my life to in sort of developing this craft, that's where literature comes in. Because literature has other types of connecting of these bits of information, right? Mm-hmm. It weaves patterns together. And there's a really interesting argument that, we might think of our interactions and our language in terms of the technologies that are most prevalent in our day, mm-hmm. right? In our day, of course, we think of our own brains in terms of computers and cell phones, right? But in a day in which there were different forms of traditional work, say like weaving or spinning among women, and one would be a storyteller, it might be that in some sense that very mode of interaction, that social work, right, the weaving, the spinning, actually got into the very way that we structured language. Mm-hmm. In this way, we need not just literature, but we need pre-modern literature. We need older literature because it operated and functioned with different types of patterns than our and now kind of digital logic, the datification of our lives. It's just little bits of information. But mm-hmm. our older literature creates these wonderful sort of these webs of patterns. For example, as you well know, right, in Homer, if a Homeric hero asks another character, who are you? he begins by naming his fathers, right? My father was so-and-so, and his father before him was so-and-so, and his father was before. They sort of placed themselves in this long line. Thus, the patterns were different. They're more like a web of weaving together all these pieces and parts that make me, as opposed to these individual sort of data cloud of experiences. And then I think reading literature, when we get good at it, and I think we need some work, because we've sort of habituated ourselves to these types of, you know, forms of datafication communications, right? Mm-hmm. But if we can recover the ability to get good at that type of literary communication, get good at dwelling with old and difficult text, I think it is therapeutic and healing. As it helps us bring together the sort of fragmented bits of our personality.
C.S. Lewis, whom you mention in your book, you know, you have a lot of love for his work. Lewis said that for every two modern books he read, he would read one very old book.
That's right.
And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, that in some ways the school systems are abandoning very consciously. They sometimes will put the issue in terms of all these dead white men who were writing. Mm. You don't have women, you don't have people of color, etc. And therefore they can be rejected. They're dismissed, not because the literature is of a good quality or poor quality, but because it doesn't meet certain stereotypes that we think we should include for diversity. Mm-hmm. Whereas it misses the great diversity that existed beyond any of their what we call their identities. Right. They were just filled with great insight. And to read Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and to read Dante, mm-hmm. one of your areas mm-hmm. of specialty, and these other great writers does us good. And, you know, maybe not so many of the immediately contemporaneous writers are as great an advantage.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's an easy way to think through this, that we now live in an age in which on a daily basis, we exchange more kilobytes of information than were contained in all of the pre-modern libraries over millennia.
Combined,
mm-hmm. right? From Gilgamesh to Dante, right? Mm-hmm. From Gilgamesh to Shakespeare. And you would think at first that, you know, such sort of powers of communication, right, would be wonderful and would connect us. But the reality is, at the same time, this is also the anxious generation, Jonathan Haidt calls it, right? We are alone together, Shirley Turkle puts it, right? We're the most lonely and detached and anxious generation ever. Mm-hmm. So how is it that these tools of connection and communication can coexist with this feeling of radical isolation? So in some sense, I mean, there's definitely a democratic good in including more voices, in including voices of depth and genius, which, you know, could have been excluded. There's a good to that. But if it goes to the absolute extreme, a pure sort of individualization, we all feel alone, right, rather than connected. So I think with respect to, you know, the great literary tradition, our communication lacks wholeness and it lacks depth. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think we need these old books. I mean, it might sound funny for some to hear it, right? But Milton and Homer and Dante and Shakespeare, I think, are more urgent than the daily news. Why? Because they possess wholeness and depth. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows that that's part of the crisis of anxiety right now, where I don't feel that I can even express myself because I don't even have the sort of sufficient tools. You could put it like this, right? If you only had one or two keys on the piano, say like an F and a G, you couldn't make a very interesting composition. No. Literature gives us back those 88 keys and allows us to play the depth, to deal with our broken and hurt and wounded nature as human beings, right? But then it allows us to go to the heights, right? Those high treble clef notes, right? And explore, longings of for love and beauty that we can hardly even explain to ourselves. Yeah. That's in sense. That's why we owe such a debt of gratitude to our ancestors, and why what we need, you know, what they had with a sense of urgency.
Yeah, this is something that the superficiality of some of modern literature, where it focuses on our modern experiences and doesn't give a variety. For instance, when you quote poetry in your book, and these poems give very rich descriptions of different scenes, so that as you hear or read the description, you can understand the not only the emotional reaction, but also the scene itself. Whereas some of the modern writings are fairly superficial and let's say monotone. They're just a few notes.
Right,
And it's not all of them. And we become less, and it becomes more boring. And that boredom, I think, contributes to the way that people feel isolated and depressed.
Yeah, well, I always like to say to my students, you know, imagine that what we, you know, we live in a trending culture, right? In which, you know, there's a trendy, you know, social movement per year, right? Hashtag fill in the blank. Now, a lot of these times, these things are actually real concerns of justice, right?
Sure.
But we're only allowed as a society to have one preoccupation per year. And we have a campaign, and everyone's fussed at, and everyone's canceled, right? And then there's a new campaign. Mm-hmm. But it's not like we've, you know, solved the problem with the campaign, right? But in some sense, that kind of trending culture, we think, you know, one thing at a time, one virtue at a time, one, to even be generous, right? One value at a time. I think, you know, what we're describing is when you build a web of connections, you're thinking as the human being is not as an individual who needs one virtue at a time, but a man or a woman who needs 33 different virtues, just to choose almost an arbitrary number, right? Or 33 different values to be a complete and whole human being, right? So I think that that type of literature, the type of song, that reduces it to one single point with gusto, with slam effect, right? The reason it feels a little empty, the reason it feels suffocating, is because it's not giving us a picture of the how complicated we are as human beings, right? I need to be pure, I need to be loyal, I need to be a good friend, I need to be a good father, I need to be a good husband, I need to be a good teacher, I need to be diligent, I need to have a sense of humor, I need to have the capacity to wonder, I need the capacity for beauty, I need courage, tenacity, we could go on, right? But that's the classical Western view of being a human. That's the, which the Christian, you know, Dante, the master, right, inherited. Human beings are complex, and we're always forgetting.
Yes.
And thus, in some sense, the beauty of what we get to do, if we just appreciated it, is to reconnect with the depth of the past, and thus provide ourselves with a sufficient number of keys on the piano board to express the depth of my soul. As I put it in the book, the world is as wide as the soul is deep. And if we limit our vision of the world, if we limit our vision as well as the past, then we're going to have a narrow, monotonous understanding of what it means to me, for me to flourish as a contemporary human.
When you take the person who is, by general agreement, the greatest playwright of the English language, William Shakespeare, you see what a variety of scenes and people that he deals with, from, you know, comedies, historical dramas, and tragedies, and even among those tragedies and historical plays and comedies, there are different scenes that he's dealing with, and he stirs up different kinds of humor in Midsummer's Night Dream than he would in As You Like It, you know? It's just not the same. And for us, I think to maybe we can't always get to a Shakespeare play. especially when they're not offered. But you can't find great presentations. You know, there are great movies and recordings of Shakespearean plays. You can at least get that and experience the play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as well as read it, but or seeing the play acted, that gives us a depth, you know, and a variety that you can't get in a lot of more recent things.
Yeah, I like that our conversation has a little bit of a key change from a minor key to a major key, because I don't want people to think that this is a mere critique of technology.
Nope.
It's not a mere critique of tools, right? It's not I love being modern, and I don't think I'd want to live in any other age.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that great opportunity, right? Is precisely because we have these types of tools, right? We have access to a type of education that kings and dukes would envy us for. Right?
Yeah.
We have access to these types of things, and they're available to anyone who loves, to anyone who cares. And we just have to sort of awaken that desire, right?
Yes.
That hunger for beauty.
Exactly. And really, yes, truly seek it out and let it affect us. We have to take a little break. If you want more information on Dr. Baxter's work, you can go to his website, which is jasonmbaxter.com. jasonmbaxter.com. See, he uses the technology.
That's right.
He also has a Substack site, and that's jasonmbaxter.substack.com. I never even heard of Substack sites.
Maybe easier to search for Beauty Matters, Jason
Beauty.
Baxter.
There yeah. you go, Beauty Matters, Jason Baxter. So we'll get some of that and you can learn more about what he's up to. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, get some of your questions and comments, so please stay with us. We are speaking with Dr. Jason M. Baxter, and we're discussing it's a short book. It's not very long, and part of the delight of the book is that it does include so much poetry. You demonstrate what you're saying with actual nice pieces of quotation of Yeats and other poets. And his book is called Why Literature Still Matters. You can get it at our EWTNRC.com, religious catalog. It is item number 52017, 52017. And again, it's not real long, but it's delightful, and it helps to elucidate some of this. We also you mentioned this, Cuthbert's Way. Who was St. Cuthbert?
Yeah, St. Cuthbert was a medieval English saint, 7th century, right? He's been called the British St. Francis. Bede thought that he was proof that even the English could be holy. And so Bede writes about him. And
Bede, by the way, was English himself.
He was. He was delighted that that Northern England now had their own. Cuthbert grew up in this border region of Southern Scotland and Northern England. And eventually, after an incredible spiritual vision, made his way to the island of Lindisfarne, which is just off the coast of England, now known as Holy Island. And that's where he became abbot of a famous monastery there until he spent the last couple of years as a hermit on an even farther out island, seeking his own desert of the waves. So there's a trail that now begins in Melrose, Scotland, and runs 62.5 miles, crosses the border, goes down into England, goes past a cave where Cuthbert's body was lodged for a time when they were trying to flee the Vikings, and then the trail goes down to the water and crosses over. So it recreates, in a way, Cuthbert's own life through a kind of a pilgrimage in the Scottish border regions.
Yeah, and Lindisfarne Monastery was one of the real terrible attacks by the Vikings, one of the early and very important attacks. I destroyed it, but this is well before they ever got to it. And we're going to show this on the way of St. Cuthbert. It'll be on Saturday, January 17th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. Let's show a little clip. We've got that ready.
In a windy August in 2025, I teamed up with Father Marcus Holden and my friend Dan to take a group of Benedictine college students to hike St. Cuthbert's Way, a 62.5 mile trail that runs along the border of England and Scotland. We came from all over and were drawn by different things, but we all had one thing in common, a sense that a long forgotten saint had something that our contemporary world still needed.
For those of us not from this charmed region along the Scottish and English borders, St. Cuthbert is a relatively unknown figure. But in his own age, he was what, say, St. Francis was in the world of Dante, or what St. John Paul II has become for our age. He was the great saint of the 7th century, the great saint of the Age of Bede, the great saint of the age of the Book of Kells and the Lindisfarne Gospels, the great saint when Iona and Lindisfarne were powerhouses of prayer. And thus, if we want to understand him, we have to understand him as the heir of Celtic Christianity.
And the music of this is by a group of Dominicans known as the Hillbilly Thomists.
Yes, that's right.
They use a lot of bluegrass style in their music, and they compose some of their own music as well.
They do.
So
yeah, it's kind of fun.
It's not exactly your regular Scottish music.
Well, Southern, bluegrass music is just Scottish music, deep fat fried in the Appalachians, right?
So. Deep fat fried, but also I remember listening to Bill Monroe, who really came up with bluegrass. And it was a combination of African American and mountain people music. And like you say, deep fat fried.
Well, it's kind of fun because the soundtrack tells a little bit of a story too, right? At the beginning, when we're showing, us wide-eyed Americans who are going to the old world, right? We have our own music. We have Hillbilly Thomist, right? The sort of, remote traditional culture. But the film ends with Benedictine choir singing the music of Sir James Macmillan, his beautiful O Radiant Dawn, timed to a time-lapse shot of the sun rising over Lindisfarne. So it was kind of a cool moment in which Sir James Macmillan came to Kansas, received an award from us. Our choir sang his music back to him. But then we went to his world and are using his music to help us kind of think through the beauty of this northern region.
Mm-hmm. And I think getting back to a saint that, again, is not well known anymore,
right,
and once was, but remains a Catholic saint. Mm. And you mentioned that they hid his body from the Vikings. Do they still have custody of it?
Well, it was hidden for a while in a cave, mm-hmm. and then it went to a series of other shrines in northern England. And now it's finally arrived where it's been for a millennium. So new history for the English, right?
Yeah.
But in Durham Cathedral. And that's where our final shots in this film end in and around Durham Cathedral, where the relics of Cuthbert are now.
Oh, I see. Okay. And it's good to have that understanding of these medieval saints. they're not irrelevant.
No.
You know, they really can, you know, give us a perspective. I mean, when you go back to literature, I really enjoyed having come across a recording of Beowulf in the old English. It wasn't translated into modern English. It was an old English. And that that Beowulf was wonderful to listen to. In that, it took a while before I could recognize the English of it, but I could. And this is a great gift that we can have with these saints as well, these medieval holy people that were very much trying to find Christ, and they sought him and that relationship with him, and at the same time were transforming their society. The Benedictines were absolutely essential for the transformation of barbarians into Christian Europeans. It's just remarkable to have all this, and it's a good model for what we need to do with our own modern society.
Yeah, I sometimes like to describe my work as a professor and as a writer, as rummaging around in the basement of the church, right? You find these objects which are absolutely priceless, but people just got sort of bored with it, or, you know, grandma forgot that thing was up in her attic.
Right? Yeah.
But you could pull these things out like, huh, The Life of Cuthbert by Bede,
yeah.
Right? And my goal was to take that, you know, seventh century life, recontextualize it in the world in which it once made sense, and see if something could come alive from it.
Yeah.
And that way I thought, well, what we were doing, we were using our own contemporary technologies, you know, film, to do for Cuthbert what the technologies of his day, the illuminated manuscripts, had also done. So we were creating a digital illuminated manuscript. Mm-hmm. We were using film in our particular techniques, but in a way to try to retell a story, to ask ourselves what the significance of this life of holiness was.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a cool thing. What was the reaction of your students to this trip and to Cuthbert? How did they perceive him?
Well, the cool thing is we actually, in the film, we have a series of interviews with the students, so they can, you know, they can tell you themselves. But I think it was a mixture of gratitude and wonder and joy and humor, and just a series of sort of, you know, surprises and happiness. But also, I think, yeah, this wasn't just a tourist trip. This had something that had the value of a pilgrimage. It had some depth to it. There are moments in which people just wanted to contemplate the beauty of the place and to be quiet. So I think it exceeded all possible hopes that I had for what this could be.
Yeah, and that's, again, getting back to what we were talking about, because being able to contemplate and experience great poems, great stories, beautiful music, and paintings and sculptures are very, very important. But in many ways, having those pieces of art came from people who had contemplated life and nature, that oftentimes they were aware of nature. They could describe things well because they knew them and they thought about them. And it's not only the art, but the condition for making great art is to be in nature and observe what's going on within nature, mm-hmm. and let that transform us. This is a very important element as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the pulse of why literature still matters. The sort of breakthrough discovery for me was going on this hike in Sardinia, in which I ran out of water and got dehydrated, and my rational faculties were failing me. And yet, nevertheless, I made it to this incredibly beautiful site. and found myself thinking, wait, why am I enjoying this? And then later I realized, oh, because the gap between me and the natural environment has disappeared, right? Mm-hmm. I've closed the gap between what I see and who I am. Mm-hmm. And then in my mind, I remembered, oh, this is exactly how C.S. Lewis describes the secret desire of literature and the secret desire of art, right? I don't just want to see beauty, I want to be beauty. I don't want to just see beauty, I want to eat beauty, right? I want to see those natural, the beauty of the natural. And then I want to reach down and find words or chords or scales or painting, and I want to pull it out and express it in my own language. And I think this is a deeply biblical idea, right? That yes. Paul says that all of creation is groaning to sing a hymn to God. Well, human beings have the privilege and the faculty to loan our voices to the natural world and elevate that groaning into a hymn. And that's what art is good for.
And see, this gets at a very traditional part of our Christian faith, that we seek the good, the true, and the beautiful.
Hmm.
That the pursuit of God is to contemplate what is the eternal truth, good, and beautiful.
Yes.
In that the good and the truth are always going to be beautiful, and the beautiful, truly beautiful, will always be good and true.
Right.
In this way, art is something that is pointing us towards God, our Lord.
Right.
And we see that kind of contemplation, say, in the Psalms.
Right.
You know, so often, besides expressing the problems of life and the struggles of life, it's also Psalms like 104 or Psalm 8 that express the beauty of nature. You know, that in Psalm 8, that wonderful line, "What is man that you consider him, the son of man that you remember him, and yet you have made him little less than the angels." And I, looking carefully at the Hebrew, I prefer to translate, "You have made him lack little from God."
Mm-hmm.
That's probably more the sense. And it then contemplates the sun and the moon right before that to say, you know, I look at the moon and the stars, and because it's moon and stars because it's the nighttime meditation, that evokes this sense of wonder with God. And that's another thing that's missing. A lot of times people who are also depressed don't see meaning in life,
mm-hmm.
and they don't see God.
Mm.
And seeking the beautiful, the true, and the good can move them in that direction.
Yeah, I think we could do an interesting thought experiment at the same time. We could ask ourselves, well, what if, you know, what if we only had access to truth and rationality? Well, we'd have a boring, sterile, academic religion, which would be nothing more than a philosophical dispute. What if we only had goodness? Well, I think we'd have a type of, we'd have a type of charity, but lacked any sort of real human connection, right? And if you only had beauty, well, you'd just be a French film director watching himself smoke a cigarette in the mirror all day long, right? I mean, these things actually have to complement each other, right? Our truth needs goodness and our goodness needs beauty. But one of the most beautiful things that I've seen about my Angelico fellows at Benedictine College is when coming into contact with beauty, they feel fully alive. Right? They feel like something deep, that yes. narrative that we've been looking for in our fragmented age awakens. And I think the beauty gives an element of depth and an element of meaning to the truth and goodness.
Yes. Yeah. This is why I believe it's St. Augustine that had put those three together and help us to say this is what we want. And it also speaks to something else that I believe St. John gets at in the book of Revelation. That is a book less about trying to decipher the precise names, dates, and places for the end of the world than it is awakening us to the ugliness of sin and the beauty of God in heaven. That's the contrast that you see of how ugly and mean sin makes us, and how filled with love and beauty and truth that holiness makes us. And it divides up between the kingdom of Satan and ancient Babylon and the kingdom of God and the new and heavenly Jerusalem. That idea of combining truth, beauty, and goodness is also that picture for heaven. And we want those reflections of it here on earth as well. That's a very important aspect in all this. Again, I want to make sure that we let people know more about your work so they can get to it. There's the website, jasonmbaxter.com, mm-hmm. and the book that he wrote, we've been discussing, again, not a very long one. It's only about 75 pages of
text. That's right, yeah. Just enough to whet the appetite.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a good and rich one. It's called Why Literature Still Matters by our guest, Dr. Jason M. Baxter. You can get it at EWTNRC.com, where it's item number 52017. Besides producing all that, The Way of St. Cuthbert will be shown this Saturday, January 17th, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. We urge you to get a chance to look at it. That'd be well worth enjoying that pilgrimage and yes. getting to know a little bit more about St. Cuthbert, one yes. of the great medieval saints that we don't know so well anymore. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. I assume that
being that you're pretty young, you'll keep doing more work, so well, keep that up.
I've got several contracts out there that need to be fulfilled, so.
There you go, there you go, but that's what we do. Thank you for doing all that.
Thanks, Father.
And thank you all for being with us. May Almighty God bless you and keep you and cause His face to shine upon you and lead you in all of your ways by His peace. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. And we can bring you this show and The Way of St. Cuthbert and all the other programs we do, including the upcoming March for Life in Washington. We can do all that only because this network is brought to you by you, keeping us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill. That makes it possible to pay our bills and do all this for you. God bless you and thank you.